This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Sean Tubbs. Welcome to the first of hopefully many podcasts from the Neon Guild, an association of technology professionals in the Charlottesville Albemarle area. Each month, the group gathers to meet and greet, drink pizza and beer, and hear a speaker talk about some issue related to technology. This month, the topic is My Company 101, a primer from attorney Dan Smith on the many types of business arrangements possible for small business owners. Dan will describe himself in just a second, but first a disclaimer from me. What you're about to hear does not consist of legal advice. Dan will explain more fully, and here he is at the Neon Guild on January 16th, 2006.
My name's Dan Smith. I'm an attorney, solo practice. I sort of specialize in small businesses, have an interest in tech-based companies, other companies that use technology, or those that create technology, which basically covers everybody. I've been to the Guild, I guess, two, three times before to sort of give little talks on things that people are interested in, and was asked to sort of kind of pitch in, and I saw a little bit of traffic on the, I guess it's not really a bulletin board, but the listserv about some questions that were popping up, and Deborah and Jack thought it'd be a good idea to sort of have me just sort of come in and pop off and give you my thoughts on some of the things that folks were discussing. As with all things legal, I need to disclaim sort of everything I say.
Especially since we don't have a record of it on the podcast.
That's right. Now with this podcast, yeah, I'm a little bit more nervous that I can be held to some of this stuff. But the information I'm about to give is for informational purposes only. It's sort of for your own edification and mine as well. It does not constitute legal advice. Everyone's got situations that may be somewhat similar or sound very similar. But as I have been practicing law, there's always sort of the unstated that can completely change what somebody's analysis of a certain situation would be. And that's about 99% of the time. You only get half of what the client wants to tell me and about 25% of what I really need to know to address the issue. And it's generally not until I get into it that I find out, oh, you know, that would have been really important to know before I said certain things. So with that caveat and that disclaimer in mind, Deborah set up some, had some questions in sort of the announcement for the topic, and I'm just going to kind of go through those things and sort of give you my thoughts, you know, these little questions. And then after that, I'm just going to open it up. I think I do better that way, just sort of hearing what's on your mind, and then again, sort of giving you my two cents. Just based on what you've told me. If I really have no idea what the answer will be, I will tell you that I have no idea what the answer will be. And if you're really interested, I'm happy to kind of take a look and see what I can figure out. I'm always interested in sort of helping me educate myself, and I found that my clients are my best teachers as they come up with really unique and interesting sort of scenarios that require me to kind of go in and dig around and be creative and think about the problem and then try to come up with some sort of solution. If there's something that comes up here that's a, you know, real stickler and somebody really wants me to follow up, just let me know, give me an email address, and I'll dig around and, again, sort of give you my two cents and go from there. I represent sort of additional disclaimer. I represent Jack and PeopleSpace, Deborah and DRW Designs, and Mark and OptiPop. I helped set them up. It's entirely possible I may have helped some other folks here, too, as well. Again, sort of keep an eye on the listserv and popping off with some stuff every now and then. The thread that sort of got the whole discussion started was there was some talk of some folks that were sole proprietors, and they were thinking about either leaving the job and sort of doing their own thing, or a sole proprietor is like, you know, what do I need to do? Should I create some sort of legal entity? I've heard of these things called, you know, corporations. You all know about corporations. We see those initials LLC, an LP. I've formed a PLC. And, you know, is that something that I really need to do in order to get into business?
Real quick, does sole proprietor have any greater definition than what it sounds like?
That's exactly what it is. Sole proprietor is somebody going out and starting their own business. Folks that say that they're free agents, unless you've created any sort of a business entity, you're a sole proprietor. The little kid who opens up the lemonade stand by himself along the side of the street is a sole proprietor. And a sole proprietor is just that. Someone just goes into business for themselves. However, if they take somebody on, then you've created a partnership. And so two sole proprietors put together create a partnership, another sort of creation of common law. There isn't anything that you really need to file in order to create a partnership. There's a body of law that defines how a partnership works when two people come together in a common goal for a business purpose. You can sort of, I guess, working our way through the legal entities, the partnership has special tax consequences, tax forms that need to be filed called a Schedule K. And there's also, as I mentioned, a body of law that defines sort of how partnerships work, how they're broken up, how profits and losses are divided. And that body of law can be modified by an agreement between the partners, aptly called a partnership agreement. And that partnership agreement can take you out of the common law or the statutes that are on the books that govern partnerships. So certain things you want to change. For example, if you want the distribution of profits to be something other than 50-50, a partnership agreement would tell you how those profits would be divided. People also sort of operate in unwritten agreements. So like, well, I'm going to make you 75%. Or actually, I'll make you 25%, and I'll be the 75% partner. And people can behave and go along that way. Profits come in; they sort of divide them up the way that they've sort of talked about. But if there's a dispute that pops up, then it becomes sort of a he said, he said, she said, she said, as to how things would actually be divided up, requiring additional proof and that sort of thing. So the next sort of group or business operation, we'll call that the partnership. And partners, of course, can be never one, and then as many partners as you possibly want. Other types of partnerships that you generally don't see a lot of in business operations, you've probably heard of a general partnership. A general partnership is an operation where each of the partners has joint and several liability for the debts of the partnership. And what that means is if the partnership goes out and borrows $100,000, each individual partner is liable for $100,000. And so if your partner is unscrupulous, takes $100,000 and dashes off to the Caribbean, someplace where he can't be extradited, the bank would look to you, the remaining partner, for the full $100,000, not just $50,000.
What would be the advantage of entering into an agreement like that?
It's a simple business, organization. It doesn't require any sort of specific filings at the state. It's certainly not an agreement that, in times past, certain types of business operations had to be operated as a general partnership. For example, in Washington, D.C., it's only been recently, but all law firms had to operate as general partnerships. The reason why they did that is that they wanted to make sure that everybody sort of would police, you would police your other partners to make sure that they were not unscrupulous, would practice law with the highest standards. The way to do that is to say, okay, well, if your partner commits malpractice, blows it in some way, steals the client funds, all you other guys are on the hook completely for that amount. And so it was a way of regulation for certain types of business associations. You'd see it with generally professional associations. You'd see that accountants requirement.
That one too.
Pardon? Accountants, medical practices, engineers, other groups that were required to have a general partnership. The other type of partnership is what's called a limited partnership. A limited partnership has a very specific definition of the tax code in that a limited partner had to be a passive partner, but their losses were limited to the contribution that they made into the partnership. And so you form a limited partnership. You see this a lot with investment vehicles. I would, you know, ask you all for $10,000. I would be the general partner. I would collect the money and I would buy a building and I would rent the building. You all would just get financial reports. You wouldn't have any active role in the partnership. If you did take an active role in the partnership, then you would become a general partner like myself. But it was it's a vehicle so that if the building were to burn down and I had it uninsured, and someone were to try to collect, the most they could get from each of the limited partners was the amount of their investment, which would, in that case would be $10,000 in this case. You see these are increasing, they're becoming more and more rare, but you still see these a lot in investment vehicles where a fund will create a limited partnership, go out and raise money. Again, there's sort of that self-policing in that the general partner has this unlimited liability, and what that does is it gives comfort to the limited partners that the general partner is not going to abscond with the money. Additionally, the use of general partnerships is one that is very well established in the law, has a long tradition, and so people are comfortable with the form when they're investing their money. You know how the taxes are treated in a limited partnership. You know what the business laws associated with a limited partnership. So people are comfortable with the form. May not be the most advantageous, but there's a lot. You know, they know a lot about it, and so they go on to the limited partnership. Getting away from sort of the partnership, sole proprietor types of organizations, the next sort of more formal, yeah. Yeah, I'll get into. Yeah, I'll talk about that. Just remind me, because I will go off track and then completely forget, and then have to come back to it. But the next type of entity are the more formal entities, and this is sort of what some of the discussion was about. The first type and one that has sort of a much longer pedigree is the corporation. And the corporation's a form that we're all pretty familiar with. You have a company, an entity, and that entity raises its money and is owned by shareholders. And we have IBM stock, AT&T stock. A shareholder owns a little bit of piece of the company, and the company is run by a board of directors, and the board of directors is elected by the shareholders. And then that board of directors elects and appoints officers of the corporation. The officers of the corporation do the day-to-day they run the company itself. And in smaller entities, of course, the shareholder, the directors, and the officers can all be the same people. There are no restrictions on sort of dividing between the two entities.
Can one person be a corporation?
One person can be a corporation, yep. A corporation is a legal creation. It is created by making a filing with the State Corporation Commission in Virginia, the Secretary of State in other states. You file what are called Articles of Incorporation. The statute defines what has to be in those Articles of Incorporation. You file the articles. You pay a fee. The state reviews them, provided they are proper in form, and the name has not been used before. Bingo presto, you now have created a corporation. A corporation, and this also sort of this concept flows over into the LLC, is a legal entity so that when a corporation is created, it is actually a legal person that sits next to the board of directors and the shareholders and the officers. It's got a name, it has life, which for some time in this country, sort of early on in the founding, there was sort of this suspicion of this creation called a corporation, and that you had a state-created person running a business, and people were suspicious of corporations. But the corporation is a legal entity, has life, has being, and as a result, it needs care and feeding in order for it to survive and to have any sort of legal meaning. The next type of entity is a more recent creation. I believe the first was formed in Wyoming, I want to say the mid-80s, and that's a limited liability corporation, limited liability company. Yeah.
Before you move on to that, can you tell us about the difference for the subchapter?
Yes. There are, in the tax code, two different types of corporations. You have what's called a C corporation, subchapter C corporation, and a subchapter S corporation. A subchapter C is a corporation that we are more familiar with. Not that there are more of them, but we're more familiar with them because all of the big companies that are corporations are C corporations. And a C corporation in the tax code is treated as a separate individual. We'll call it an individual, a separate entity. In that, the C corporation, when it collects its revenues and has its income, all of the deductions that go against that income, the expense deductions, happen within the C corporation. You, the shareholder, don't get the benefit of those deductions. So if you've got AT&T, AT&T spends $1 million on automobiles, that expense doesn't flow through to the shareholder. That all stays in AT&T. The result is, of course, that AT&T pays taxes on its income. And when it makes a distribution to the shareholders pay a tax on the distribution that they receive from the company. And so in sort of the common colloquial, it's a double tax organization. The organization pays a tax on its income, and then any income that goes out to the shareholders pay a tax on that income. And so the income is taxed twice. A subchapter S corporation is a small corporation. The IRS has a large number of rules about sort of how a subchapter S corporation, what qualifies as a subchapter S corporation, what types of stock a subchapter S corporation can issue, who can hold subchapter S S-corp stock. But the benefit is that it is a single tax organization in that the income and deductions flow through to the shareholders. The income doesn't stop at the sub-S, the expenses don't stop at the sub-S, and then you have this math that takes place at the sub-S, and then the sub-S pays the tax. But rather, all of the benefits, income, deductions, all flow through to the shareholders. And it is this organization that most small businesses, if they're not, they generally want to be, because it's, as a small company, you don't want to pay taxes twice on that same pool of money, especially given if it's a small corporation. There isn't sort of that play there, like, okay, well, we want to take advantage of certain, there are certain tax advantages that a C corp has that a chapter sub S doesn't have. But for small businesses, you're not going to be able to qualify for those items anyway. And so rather than be a C corp, have your money taxed, then have it flow to you, and then have it taxed again, the IRS allows, through a restricted type of corporation, the subchapter S corp, those benefits to flow through. So you're only taxed on that money once, as opposed to twice. In response to the sub S, there was an entity, I believe it's of German origin, the limited liability company, and the limited liability company, for tax purposes, looks a lot like a subchapter S company. The benefits, the income, flow through the LLC and go straight to the people that own the LLC. And so you don't have that double taxation issue. But the limited liability company, like I said, is a relatively recent creation, and it looks a lot like a corporation. You file papers called Articles of Organization. They create a name. You follow the sort of the statutory requirements. You file the paper with the state. You pay a fee to the state. The state reviews the papers. The check clears. Everything looks good. It creates an entity called a limited liability company. The limited liability company, just like a corporation, is a separate and distinct entity. It is sort of the other person in the business sitting at the table with everybody. The benefit to the LLC, what makes it different from a corporation, has to do with sort of how the ownership structure. I mean, it looks very similar to that of a corporation, but in an LLC, I guess one way to think of it is sort of a super limited partnership. And this is what I mean, in that the people that own an LLC are called members, and they hold membership interests in the LLC. And the law treats these people who are members basically as partners in this business. The benefit, however, is that a person who is a member of an LLC, their liability is limited to whatever they put into the LLC. Just like a stockholder who buys $100 worth of stock in AT&T will never ever lose more than $100. Even if, you know, AT&T goes bankrupt, the creditors of AT&T cannot go to you, the shareholder, and say, well, I know you just paid $100 and you just own $100 worth of AT&T, but they owe us, you know, if we were to divide it out, every shareholder were to owe us $1,000. The creditors can't go to you. Your losses are limited to whatever you put in to a corporation. The same is true with a limited liability company. The members' losses, the members' exposure is limited to whatever investment they put in to the limited liability company. Again, looks a lot like a corporation, except the people who are not shareholders are called members. You don't own stock. You own units. It's not articles of incorporation, but articles of organization. And for tax purposes, the IRS allows basically treats the entity as a flow-through organization. No matter how big the organization gets, no matter what types of equity you provide in the organization, and this is what I mean by that. In a subchapter S, you can only provide one class of stock. Now, I'm going to guess if people have heard of like preferred shares of stock and that sort of thing. A preferred share will have a different voting right. It may take a different distributions. They may get paid first, a dividend first, and then everyone else gets paid first. There may be a preference for liquidation. So, for example, if things don't go well and then you decide to sell everything, someone that holds a preferred stock may get their money out first, and then everybody else who owns sort of regular shares gets paid. You can't have that sort of thing in a subchapter S. Everyone's in it together. On an LLC, you can have different types of units, preferred units, unpreferred, you know, common units. And so an LLC provides a lot of flexibility that you would get with a C corporation, but you get the benefit of it being a pass-through sort of single tax entity. And so you only pay taxes on your money once with an LLC as opposed with the C corporation. Yeah?
What if an LLC fails and the liabilities are greater than the amounts that the individuals have put in?
Then the creditors just go knocking on the door and you know, crying, basically. I mean, the amount of money in the LLC, you know, that's sort of... that's it. That's what's there. And if a creditor loaned money to the LLC only, the LLC borrows $100,000, there's only $1,000 in the LLC. LLC goes belly up. That $100,000, you know, each of the members of the LLC said, "Well, I put in my money. It's gone now." Creditors can knock on the door, but you don't have to answer because you have a liability shield. And that sort of actually takes me into sort of like, why would you even bother to sort of, you know, do these sorts of things. Why, you know, why have corporations? Why have LLCs? Why have why bother? This is form partnership. Go charging ahead, full bore. Just sort of run my business that way. Because it's not.
If someone sues you, they can take your house.
That's right. That's right. The issue is that these entities are called limited liability entities, which give you a clue as to kind of what it's all about. Is that these entities provide a business owner with what's called a liability shield. So, as a stockholder in a business, my liability is limited to the amount of money I use to buy my stock. As a member in an LLC, my liability is limited to the money that I put into the company to get a membership unit out of it. So if the business fails, I'm like a creditor with everybody else. I put $1,000 into this LLC. I put $1,000 into Charter Communications, for example, and that's it. And they kind of go belly up. I've lost my $1,000, but the creditors cannot come to me. If, however, you are a sole proprietorship or a general partnership, everything you own is at risk. So your house, your car, all the stuff in your house, the clothes on your back, all becomes at risk. Yeah, sort of future earnings. Yeah, I mean, you can really be, messed up for life without a liability shield. And that's the huge, huge advantage of these limited liability entities. Yeah?
If you form an LLC, for example, I've been implementing for the last several years, and even when I use the DBA, business name, I have a company that protects me as an individual because I'd rather not tie up cash in a separate business account and pay the fees for a business account and have all that, set up separately. If you are established as, a legal LLC, do you need to use a business account, or can you still have checks for what you can use?
That's an excellent question. And that's sort of
could you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. For the folks listening on the podcast. The question is, if you form an LLC, do you have to have separate business account and sort of operate that entity as basically another individual? And the answer is yes. That's sort of the downside of creating a legal entity through which to operate your business. That legal entity, in order for it to have any sort of benefit to you as a shield for liability, you have to treat that entity as a separate individual. And so your business has to have a business bank account. The business will hold the business license. If you do a lot of work for the business, it's ideal to have either a consulting agreement or an employment agreement with that entity. Even though it's just you, everything that you can do to show that I treat this entity as a separate and distinct, basically, person from myself, it's not my alter ego, all of those actions represent the care and feeding of that entity. Without that, let's say you had an LLC and you got in a car accident and you were like on business, and the plaintiff, they look at the business and it's got like $10,000. You kind of keep it cash poor because you pay yourself, a fair and reasonable salary, but it just doesn't generate a whole lot of cash. It's not sitting in the bank. The plaintiff's attorney will attempt to what's called pierce the corporate veil, which is to show a court, look, that company, that LLC is just a sham. They don't respect what's called the corporate formalities, in that they don't have a separate business account. It's just, all the money just goes into one common account. They use the equipment in the car to do all sorts of things. They don't keep track of, like, here's my business. I have one car, but here's my business log, or I keep track of all the miles. They just sort of, willy-nilly, they treat everything that the business has as just common property. The it's not anything. There's no respect. You're not giving the entity any respect. And as a result, if you sort of, you know, just treat it like, you know, I just don't care. You know, I'm just going to write checks out of it and sort of do whatever you know, just pretend it's not even there. The plaintiff can convince the court, look, it's just a sham. Don't give them the benefit of the liability shield. And the corporate veil is pierced, and therefore you've kind of wasted your money, wasted your time, you know, filling the piece of paper out and paying the fees every year and doing the sorts of things that, real basic things that need to be done to get the benefit, the liability benefit. And so that's the drawback. You have to maintain those formalities. Now, one of the things that makes an LLC different from a corporation is that a corporation, there are a fair number of, it's not a huge number of things, but there's certain things that you have to do as a corporation to show that you are maintaining and keeping up with the corporate formalities. Statute requires that a corporation have an annual meeting every year. You have to have an annual meeting every year. Even if it's just you, the one stockholder, shareholders have to have an annual meeting, directors have to have an annual meeting. Annual meetings have to have minutes. You have to have, recording the minutes. Any type the board of directors get together to make business decisions, you need to, have minutes. It needs to go into a minute book. Those sorts of things are required in a corporation. It has been my experience that over half of the the small businesses that I work with that are sub-S corporations have no minute books whatsoever. And so if they were to get into trouble, have some sort of accident, the first thing that a plaintiff's attorney will ask for is, let me see your minute book. Oh, here it is, and it's the thing that I got, either online, where it's got like all the blanks and stuff, and it's got like blank bylaws and blank minutes. And that's like, look, you didn't even do the basic things that you needed to do to make sure that this corporation is a viable entity.
I know, but why do that if it's just you?
You have to do it.
What are you going to do? Have a meeting with yourself?
Yeah, you have to do it.
Deborah, it's not just you.
It's you and the corporation.
It's you and it.
That's right. You and the corporation. And you actually have three hats.
Right.
That's right. It's a person, and you need to tell it what to do. And it's you as the shareholder, you as the director. It's like one person.
Well, like, what do you write down in your minute book with your meetings? Me and my corporation sat around and had a, Heineken and talked about, what we should do.
That's right. I lost, and
yeah.
I was voted down. I guess you could. I mean, there are, and you can. I mean, it's not rocket science, and it can be sort of a rote form, and you can kind of go through it, but you have to make sure you do it. LLC, on the other hand, you don't have those statutory requirements. You don't have to have an annual meeting. There's no requirement meetings of the members. There's no required meetings of the people that run the LLC, where they're called managers. And so a lot of the corporate formalities that grew up around the corporate form don't exist for the LLC. And so provided that you treat the LLC as a separate individual, and that is, having the business account and the business license and those sorts of things, the other stuff that trip people up, which are these annual meetings and these director minutes, don't exist. And so that's one of the reasons why a lot of attorneys prefer the LLC form for small businesses, because you don't have, a legal staff to make sure that you are complying with the corporate formalities that you would, these big companies have, obviously legions of attorneys that make sure all this stuff gets taken care of, corporate governance. And there's a lot of flexibility with the LLC, and it doesn't require as much care and feeding. It would sort of be a logical step to go, I'm going to have this business, I want to run my business out of my business, and I'm going to keep my separate accounts separate from my business. It's sort of a logical break, but as opposed to, I'm going to have a meeting with myself, and I'm going to document the meeting with myself, and I'm going to write this down, and then I'm going to sign it, and then I'm going to have a board of directors meeting when I'm just the single director, and then I'm going to tell my officers, who are me, I'm going to validate all the actions that you took the previous year. I mean, it just seems kind of silly, nonsensical. Clearly something devised by lawyers.
It seems to me there's a real risk that the plaintiff's attorney would
call you somebody with multiple personalities.
That's right. That's right. You're schizophrenic, and therefore shouldn't be trusted with the money. That could very well be the case. Now, sort of just to kind of move along and to talk about sort of the DBA and trade name issue. Anybody can have a DBA.
A DBA
is doing business as. It's an alias, a business alias. If, for example, you are a sole proprietor and you want to do business as Star Power, you can do business as Star Power. What you have to do, what you're required to do under the statute, is to file a certificate with the circuit court in the jurisdiction in which you use the alias. So if you were in Albemarle County, you go to the Albemarle Circuit Court, and you'd fill out, you know, your name, doing business as, and then you would file it with the court, and it would get filed in with the court. And the reason for that, I think, seems pretty straightforward. Someone says, well, I was doing business with Star Power. I don't know who that is. You go down to the courthouse, you look up Star Power and say, okay, it's, you know, Fred Jones. And here's Fred Jones' address, and he, you know, ripped me off and said, no, I can find him and I can sue him because I know where he is. And that's a DBA. Businesses can have DBAs. They raise issues, especially in today when people do business on the Internet. And if you read the statute, it says everywhere where you do business, you need to have DBA. I'm not sure what the filing fee, maybe $10, $15, something like that. You think about, you know, just all the counties and cities in Virginia, and I have like a Virginia-based business, I'm going to do a DBA. The law says, now people actually do that. It's probably honored more in the breach. But technically, you know, if you were to get in trouble somewhere, well, look, this guy didn't even file a DBA. Violated this provision of the code just for putting up your website. And that's sort of the law is still trying to work through this issue. Like, how do we do that? I mean, because you're like nationwide, and every state's got its own laws when it comes to, you know, doing business as. But that's sort of, you know, that's the DBA issue.
Filing,
that's all you need to do is file. Yep, all you need to do is file. That's right. Yes, some states have. You got to publish it in the newspaper. I'm Fred Jones. I'm a new business at Star Power. Virginia does not. Now, sort of along the lines of the DBA, I'm sure folks have heard of trademarks and service marks. Those again are different from business names. Deborah's DRW Design LLC. If she wanted to, she could probably use that as a trademark, but a trademark is not necessarily a business name. If she wanted to come up with some completely, you know, Skyweb or, you know, whatever as a trademark, she could do that as well.
Could maybe trademark my tagline?
You could trademark your tagline. That's exactly it. And a trademark is a symbol, color, words, phrase,
like this.
Just about anything. Yeah, Heineken, probably, you know, the Coke bottle shape has been trademarked, that denotes a particular source for goods or services. And so, while a business name is a very good way to identify the source of goods or services, you can also come up with some sort of a, you know, phrase or, you know, again, symbol. Pink, insulation pink is a trademark for coring. Fiberglass, no, and all that does is just denote sort of a service, but it's not the same.
The word pink, they can only trademark the way that's presented. The
color or the color, right. Yeah, there's a lot when it comes to trademark. There's a lot of rules about trademark. The only thing I wanted is there's a difference between a business name, a DBA, and a trademark. Those are three sort of different and distinct legal concepts.
What's a sole proprietor and one employee?
What's that?
What's a sole proprietor with one employee?
A sole proprietor with one employee.
Once you start adding employees to the mix, I know that people want to form entities when they start having people work for them. That seems to kind of be a bugaboo where you treat the person as a independent contractor, or you treat them as a employee?
As employee. Or? Yeah, the distinction.
What's the advantage of having them be an employee?
Well, there are certain. The distinction between sort of independent contractor and employee, a lot of the consideration that goes into, you know, how do I treat this person, are tax driven. So, for example, if you have an entity, a sub S or an LLC, and you have, you know, you want someone to do some work for you, we'll say that. Whether or not you can treat that person as an employee or an independent contractor is highly driven by the tax code. There is a method, matter, and means test, I believe is the name of the test. And it's basically, you can hire somebody as an independent contractor, and the reason why you'd want to hire somebody as an independent contractor is because you don't have to deal with the payroll taxes. You don't have to deal with the Social Security taxes, which is, you know, another additional 15% on top of whatever you pay them in a salary. As an employer, you have to match part of the Medicare tax, part of the Social Security tax, and it's an extra 15% on top of whatever you're paying that person. And so for small businesses, there's an incentive, let's treat people as independent contractors. Well, you can only treat people as independent contractors if they are truly an independent contractor. And under the code and the rulings of the IRS, that person really has to be independent in that if you say, Fred, I want you to be in the office between 8:30 and 5, and you're going to work on this computer over here, and you're going to take 30 minutes for lunch break, and I'm going to give you the task, but here's really how I need you to have it done. You're exercising a lot of control. You're telling the person when they have to be there. You're providing them with the equipment that they're going to use. You're telling them how to do certain things. They don't look very independent in the law. And as a result, you may call them an independent contractor, but the IRS is going to say, no, that person's really an employee. And as a result, you owe us 15% of what you were paying them for back taxes, and then they probably throw some penalties on it and some interest, and so it's just not not a situation which you want to find yourself, as did Microsoft some time ago, which resulted in a lot of litigation because they apparently hired a lot of people as independent contractors and had them working at the Microsoft campus, and they were providing all the tools that they were using and telling them how to do things and getting upset when, I think they were making them take vacation. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. They're employees. They look just like employees. And so in order for people to be independent contractors, they really do have to be independent, which is I need you to write code, and I need to have it by this date. And, it's got to make sure, it's got to work with kind of whatever I'm working on. But, how you get to that from point A to point B, I don't care. Just as long as you reach point B by this time and it works with this, this part of my website. You cannot... The more control you exert over that person, the less they look like an independent contractor, and the more they start looking like an employee. Yeah.
Can I ask a specific case example? What if you hire someone as hopefully an independent contractor to do a job for you? You provide them with a software tool. You don't require that they use it, but they're not really going to be able to do without it. They're going to do it at their own home and their own time with their own organization. Is that an independent contractor?
In a case like that, if you're just sort of giving, here's a software that I need to use, again, you're not giving them a whole lot of direction. Point A, point B, here's a tool that you need to use, a software tool. But, again, they're using their own equipment. It's on their own time. They're at their own home. All those, that looks more and more, less like he's coming in your office to do work like an employee and more like an independent contractor. I mean, it's just, again, it's if you think about, a current situation, we have some people working and, there's certain hours that they're sort of expected to be there and, providing the facilities, and there's just sort of a lot of things that make them look less like independent contractors and more like employees, even though you might want to call them independent contractors. You sort of think about, you know, when you were, you know, going to work someplace, does that person's situation look a lot like what I had when I was an employee? And the closer you get to that, you know, the more sort of risk you are, even if you call them an independent contractor, that, you know, if something were to blow up, you were to get audited, that you would be tagged like, no, that person's not really an independent contractor, but they're really an employee.
So when you send 1099s to someone or you get them, what's the purpose of those?
The 1099s, that is a way for the IRS to know who's getting paid what. And it's also, I'll say evidence, but it's sort of signaling to that person, I consider you an independent contractor and not an employee. And, oh, by the way, you know, I'm looking to you to handle your own taxes and take care of that. I'm not on the hook for that. That's what you're saying. Now, whether or not that actually has the actual effect that you want it to have, again, if something were to kind of happen, then it would be they would take a look at the method, manners, and means and see if they look like an employee.
Right. Well, as an LLC, do people need to send me 1099?
They do for their purposes.
Oh.
Well, and they're probably, when they issue the 1099, in your case, for tax purposes, and this is just for tax purposes, a single member LLC is invisible to the IRS. Okay. It's a true pass-through entity. DRW Designs LLC, as far as the IRS is concerned, it just doesn't exist. It's just you doing business. However, for legal liability protection, it makes all the difference in the world. Because if something were, something were to happen, indemnification provision, blows up, it's not you, Deborah Weiss, but rather DRW Design that's on the hook.
Because I have an ironclad contract prepared by Dan.
That's right. It does help to have good written agreements.
So we are contractually bound not to sue you.
Pretty much.
We try to disclaim. Yeah, disclaim everything and promise nothing is the secret to try to protect yourself on written agreements.
Is there any instance where you'd want to stay as a sole proprietor rather than becoming an LLC?
If you're just one person, would there be any reason to stay as a sole proprietor? It's much easier. First let me begin this. Lawyers are risk-averse people, which is why we all went to law school. And so we spend all our time just imagining kind of horrible things that happen to people. And some of it's realistic, some of it's not. What we try to do as attorneys, especially business attorneys, which is what I do, is sort of assess risk. Okay, the probability of X happening is pretty low, but if it were to happen, this is, here's the parade of horribles. If you have your own, sideline, I'm trying to think of like a real safe kind of business. If you don't engage in a whole lot of something, let's say
software for people.
Yeah, you're right. Like
you're
for
a programmer.
Yeah, you're a programmer. You write some software, and it's mostly for like friends or people that you know really, really well. It's primary to control things or like little games or something like that. And you're not promising them anything. You may get paid just a tiny bit. That's the thing. It's hard for me as to think of like, okay, when would I say, yeah, just go ahead and be a sole proprietorship. You just never know, and that's part of my disclaimer at the beginning. You just never know what you do, what could sort of happen. Let's say you write a program For you know, a friend of, I brew beer, so I'm gonna use this. You write a program for me that controls my fridge, so I can brew lager. So it'll step down the temperature and bring it up at a certain time. And you know, I don't know you very well, and yeah, sure, I'll go ahead and write that for you. And I put like just a whole bunch of beer, like really expensive malt and stuff like that, in it. Or I mean, this wouldn't actually happen, but. Let's say, you know, you have the temperature control and something goes wrong and the beer gets rancid. People drink it and they get really, really sick. And I can trace it back to the program you wrote. It's like, you know what? I had to pay all these people's medical bills. My insurance company is really on me because they had to pay out all this money. I mean, I wouldn't sue you, but you know what? I can't control Allstate. And they're probably going to come after you. So I just kind of want to give you a heads up. And even if they're like completely wrong, you spend a bunch of money on a legal defense for like something that's completely ridiculous. And I would admit that it's completely ridiculous. Whereas, you know, for $100 and keeping, you know, a separate account, you know, keeping your expenses down on sort of the care and feeding, you know, it's basically buying an insurance policy. And so you can do any amount of, you know, business if you're going to earn a livelihood, it just behooves you. It's an insurance policy. Deborah had on here, you know, what about liability insurance? And the sort of first insurance policy you can get is your legal liability, is your legal limited liability entity. That's insurance policy number one, because it makes it tough for someone to go after your stuff. There's an extra step that they have to go through in order to sort of get your house or get your car, get the things that really have some value to all of us. Because I mean, I don't have a ton of money in my business, but you know, I do like my house, and I don't want anybody to take my house. And so, you know, the very first insurance policy is a limited liability entity. It's like you got to sue Daniel J. Smith PLC before you can even think about getting to me.
I would say, I mean, for the last 7 or so years that I've done a lot of freelancing, I haven't worried about legal issues in part because I do marketing. You know, if you don't sell as many products, you can't always say, marketing campaign that failed. But if you're writing a single line of code, you want protection because your program may not work as they thought it would, and they may say, okay, we're not paying you. But if your program causes something else in the computer system to go haywire, now you're in trouble. And my husband is in technology, and they have things that, you know, one little thing goes wrong, and it can blow up everything. You spend a day or two of uninstalling software or, you know, rewriting a database or, you know, an e-commerce website goes down. I've been with a company where we actually did a code publish, a design publish, and a database publish at the same time, which is very stupid. And it took 48 hours to undo the damage that it did. And everyone had to get paid overtime, and the company lost thousands of dollars. You know, business they couldn't take in. You know, if you were the person who wrote that code and you didn't have a contractor, you're in. You have a problem.
And you know, as I stated, it may not even be the guy that owns the business. I mean, he may understand, it's like, look, you just did one little piece for me, you know, this. But, I mean, it's his insurance company. If they had a policy that covered the loss. The insurance companies do not like to pay people, first of all. I think we all know that. They will do kind of whatever they can not to pay you, but if they do pay you, they want someone to pay them back. And so while you know, the guy that you did the work for may say, look, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, it cost me a lot of money. I made a claim, and now my insurer is going to be coming after. It's going to give you a heads up. You're going to be getting a call from their attorney. There's nothing I can do to stop them because it's not my claim anymore.
The truth is, anybody can sue anybody for anything.
For anything, so yeah, that's right.
It doesn't have to be logical. Doesn't have to be realistic. So
yeah, that's right. It can cost you money.
So it's almost generally agreed that being a sole proprietorship is a risky proposition.
It's risky, right.
Now, if that's the case, of those other entities that you listed, there must be individual tipping points. Is it safe to assume that there are individual tipping points that point an individual and organization to be this as opposed to this? And if they are, could you tell us what those are?
Yeah, sure. The most flexible entity, the one that requires the least amount of care and feeding, basically the easiest for a small business, is the limited liability company. It's sort of the first, almost default. If somebody comes to me and says, I want to form a legal entity, limited liability company. Now, there are distinctions between the LLC and the C corporation or in the S corporation, where there are certain tax advantages to be a corporation versus an LLC, and it's primarily driven by the number of employees that you have. There are certain benefits that you can get with an S corporation, certain deductions that you can take when you provide benefits under an S corporation that are not necessarily available to an LLC. And so there's a tax driver that may push somebody when I say, well, you know what, LLC might not be a bad idea, but you know, you've got a number of employees that are doing certain things, you don't provide certain benefits. There are some tax advantages that will push somebody more into a sub S. The sub S is a creation that flowed out of this double taxation of the C corporation. And so the sub S is the child of the C. The LLC is this different, the separate thing that the IRS still, I don't say wrestling with, but they ignore it when it's a sole proprietor. So if it's just what's called a single member LLC, IRS ignores it. I just fill out, I think it's a Schedule C on my 1040, and that's it. I mean, I don't file anything under my LLC.
So in terms of doing taxes, it's basically the same.
Yeah, it's really simple.
Is it, if I'm a LLC, but I'm a sole proprietor, so in the eyes of the IRS, if I understand you, you just said I'm a sole proprietor.
Yeah, you're a sole proprietor.
If I formed an LLC and you meet all these deductions, blah, 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 are you subject to the alternative minimum tax? Or are you isolated away from that because you're an LLC?
Again, and I'm not as sure on this, I'm not a tax attorney, you would still be subject to the AMT because the IRS doesn't recognize the LLC. It's just your tax form, and you're filling out, oh, I got this income, and I'm taking these deductions, these business deductions that generated this income, just like you were an independent contractor. And so if you get tagged for the alternate, the AMT, you're still going to get tagged for the AMT, whether or not you were a sole proprietor doing it all as an independent contractor, or whether or not you ran all this money through for legal liability purposes through your LLC.
Wouldn't the deductions net out of the LLC and you only as a dividend recipient of the LLC see the net?
It depends on how you structure the LLC, whether or not you'd be able to pay dividends out. In a case like that, you're telling the IRS, don't treat it as a single-member LLC, but I want you to make it look like a corporation. What you can do, I really don't want to get into sort of that, but then you're telling the IRS to treat it in a tax different, in a way that the default rule is it's a completely pass-through entity. All the income comes into you, all the losses, all the deductions come straight to you. Yeah.
So typically, if you were a sole proprietor with doing a small amount of business, and you wanted to establish an LLC, what would you do? And how much would it cost? Or how much trouble would it be?
There are a number of places you can go online. I think there's like corporations.com or something like that that will do it. If you're really enterprise, you can get probably LLCs for Dummies. I'm sure there's something like that that's out there. You can call me. That's right, they would be the Dummies.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm the Dummies. And then the only thing I want to say, and it's not rocket science to do this. Believe me, it is not rocket science. You do not necessarily need a lawyer to organize your LLC. In fact, you can get the little form books and do it. What I would admonish you to do is when you do, if you do it that way, is to fill everything out. I cannot tell you how many times somebody does it, and you go to the Virginia State Corporation Commission website, www.sec.va.us. Maybe .gov at the end of it. Just Google it. Pops up first. They have like a doc. You can just download a doc and chop off all the kind of directions and stuff like that and just kind of fill it out. and they'll get the they get like the book from corporations.com, and then they'll have the articles of organization, and they'll have their little certificate. And then there'll be behind it what's called an operating agreement, which is basically how do I run my LLC. The statute provides sort of a set of default rules, but you can modify those default rules with a contract between the members of the LLC and the LLC saying this is how we're going to run it. And they'll get that form, and then it'll be blank. And so an issue will come up, and then you know you ask, well, let's see your book. And there's like nothing in the book except for these two pieces of paper. And then you've got to kind of look and say, make sure you had your bank account and all this other stuff separate. And if you do, you're fine. I mean, you really are fine. But sort of the more that you have that demonstrates I treated this entity as a separate and distinct entity, the better off you are. Now, what I do, have the articles of organization, have an operating agreement, even if it's a single member LLC, I have a little things, you know, single member LLC operating agreement. I'll have a little articles of a unanimous consent to organize the LLC, which says, okay, I've elected Deborah as the manager. Deborah has elected herself as the manager, and the manager is the person that runs the LLC.
Right, so can I be president?
You can be president. You can be president.
Like, no, you're the manager.
You're the manager. But you can be president if you want to be president. I mean, you can give yourself these titles. I mean, you can kind of do whatever you want. But I set up just basically a set of paper that, so if someone were to look at it and go, okay, yeah, they went through the organization process, plus they did some other things to make it look more like this is a separate and distinct entity. I recognize this entity. I'm going to treat it like a separate person. And the forms that you can get online will do the same thing. All I would say is make sure you fill them out. People just leave them blank all the time. It's just, why bother? You've just wasted your money to do that.
Why is Delaware a popular place to incorporate?
Delaware is a very popular place to incorporate. The first reason sort of got the ball rolling for Delaware is that there's no state corporate income tax in Delaware. And so people said to just flocked to Delaware when they did that. Second, Delaware has very favorable law for corporations that make it easy to do things sort of within the corporate structure. For example, I'm sure you've heard about poison pills, where a board of directors will put provisions in place whereby if someone were to try to hostily take over a company by buying all their stock, this is more for clearly publicly traded stocks and not privately, small companies. It triggers all sorts of, like, they get like huge payouts or something happens, and so it's not as enticing to sort of gobble up other companies. Those sorts of things were more readily available in Delaware. And then sort of over time, as everyone sort of incorporating in Delaware, what happened, you had a lot of litigation about, you know, what are the fiduciary obligations of the board of directors? And those guys made a completely, bonehead decision on that one, And so the shareholders sue them, there's derivative suits. Anyway, what happened over time, as soon as everyone was incorporating in Delaware, is that Delaware developed a very full, very rich body of corporate law. And so now, people incorporate in Delaware, I mean, the other benefits are still there, but you have certain assurances. You know what the duty of loyalty is in a Delaware corporation, because that matter has been litigated so many times. You know what the fiduciary obligations of a director are in Delaware, because that issue has been litigated so many times. And so for a lot of corporations, having comfort in, all right, when I get sued in Delaware on this issue, I'm pretty sure I know what the answer is going to be. And that is something that has a lot of value to very large corporations. Large corporations like risk even less than attorneys do. Maybe they like risk less because they have more attorneys. It's like, oh, they really don't like risk. And so the more that they know, the more comfortable they are, that drives, in this case, why people go to Delaware. Now, Virginia has tried to get into the race, and Virginia's corporations law looks a lot like Delaware's law, with some little twists to try to make it a bit more favorable. We have not, in Virginia, really capitalized like Delaware has. And Delaware, if you want anything from the Secretary of State, the Division of Corporations, you have to pay them money. Virginia hasn't really quite figured out that you got to charge people for everything. You can do a lot of things at Virginia for free online that you have to pay for in Delaware. And so I think we're catching up, but we haven't quite kind of stuck it to everybody like we could, you know, like they do in Delaware. So, sort of the last little thing, and then you know, I guess, you know, again, if you have any questions, let me know. The one thing that Deborah put on here is, what about liability insurance? And I think that's kind of a neat question. As I talked about before, your first line of liability insurance is the entity itself. The entity helps shield your personal stuff from actions, errors, omissions that you make through your work for the company, through your entity. So if you make an error, it's, you know, I was working as my LLC. The LLC is responsible for that work. And so that's sort of your first line of defense. The second sort of line of defense is handling risk and problems through contracts. And Deborah sort of alluded to this before. It is important, I think it's really important, because I'm a lawyer, but I think not just because I'm a lawyer, but it's important as a line of liability defense when you do work for people to get some sort of an agreement with that person that you're doing work for. And what you can put in that agreement are limitations on liability. For example, the sole proprietor who writes the code for my fridge, he puts a line, my liability is limited to whatever you paid me for to do this work. And a court will uphold that. Look, Dan, you agreed. You gave this guy $10 to write this program for your fridge. It ruined, you know, $10,000 worth of beer. You agreed to say that my liability is limited, his liability is limited to whatever I paid for the work, $10. His response is, if I say, oh, that's unreasonable, he says, well, I'm not an insurance agent. I don't know how much money the beer you're going to put into your fridge is going to be. You know, I can't, I'm not going to insure you against all losses, but I can say, you know what, you're paying me $10. I'll take that risk. I'll risk $10. I'll risk whatever you paid me if this thing doesn't work.
Can you say, I'll limit my liability to $10 for 90 days?
You can,
after you pay me?
After you pay, that's right. After you pay me, I will only, you can further limit it by time. Courts uphold business contracts. And that's another sort of benefit of having a business, your LLC. My LLC reached an agreement with your LLC or your corporation. Our businesses reached an agreement that limited my liability to a certain amount of money. And after a certain amount of time, I waive all liability. I'm not going to warrant my work. I'm not going to take any responsibility for what happens for it. We agreed to that by contract. And a court will enforce contracts. Now, granted, a court will enforce contracts. It's like, yeah, people always try to get out of the contract. They try to figure out some way, oh, this is completely unreasonable. But they're going to face an uphill fight if you have a well-crafted contract. Indemnification, which is basically, from my view, another word for just insurance, is a promise to you that, you know, if something goes wrong, I will hold you harmless. So again, the beer fridge is an issue. As a contractor or someone who's taking services from somebody, I may say, look, I want you to indemnify me if your program doesn't work. That if a third party sues me because of something you did wrong, I want you to cover me. You're trying to get that person to act as basically insurance policy. And the sort of unwritten law, but the statutes, if you don't sort of contract, statutes will provide that for you. And statutes may or may not necessarily be helpful to you in that case. And so it's very helpful to have language in the agreement that says, I will not hold you harmless. I will hold you harmless. My indemnification is limited to a certain dollar amount. One thing that sort of people that are involved in technology, especially writing software, need to be sensitive to, and this is something that as when I'm working with people that are buying IP, is I want an indemnification for non-infringement, which says you're writing software for me, you're going to guarantee to me that it doesn't infringe. And if it does, you're going to take the hit, not me. Again, but on the other side, you specifically waive that. I am not warranting this as for non-infringement. In fact, you disclaim all warranties. And so that's another way in order to sort of protect and limit your liability, another sort of insurance policy is by when you perform services and work, that you do it under a written agreement that sets out who takes the risk for if something goes wrong.
And you've run the risk of not hearing the rest of Dan Smith's talk, My Company 101. The actual presentation ran for another half an hour. The only place to hear Neon Guild speakers in their entirety is to attend a meeting for yourself. Visit neonguild.org for more information. Please feel free to pass this link around to as many people as you'd like, and contact us if you have any more questions or information about the Charlottesville Podcasting Network or WordCast Productions. You can email me at seantubbs@seavillepodcast.com or give me a call at 434-566-1217. Again, I'm Sean Tubbs, and this is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Thanks for listening.